council's ready to proceed on the next matter. Our next matter on our calendar here this morning is Anderson versus the State of Minnesota, court file A190208. I'll let you get settled there, counsel. While you're doing so, I'm sure you're both familiar with our rules. You'll both have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to exercise that. And be helpful for us if you would identify yourselves for the record as you begin your arguments. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bradford Colbert. I represent the appellant in this matter, Dean Anderson. We're asking this court to reverse Mr. Anderson's conviction for third-degree controlled substance crime because it was a serial prosecution in violation of Minnesota Statute Section 609.035. Before addressing the substantive argument, I'd like to address the procedural hurdle of State versus NAFLA. In State versus NAFLA, the Supreme Court established the principle that once a criminal defendant has directly appealed a conviction, generally all matters raised in that appeal not raised will not be considered upon a subsequent petition for post-conviction relief. In this case, the district court determined Mr. Anderson was procedurally barred from bringing this claim pursuant to NAFLA. But the district court erred for two reasons. First, because Mr. Anderson actually did raise this issue during his resentencing, and second, because fairness requires that the issue be considered.
How is it raised in resentencing?
Raised in resentencing when he brought actually a pro se motion, a written pro se motion at the time. He made the motion, and interestingly, at the time he brought the motion, the state objected to bringing the motion. And when the state objected, then the court said, basically, are you really objecting? And then the state withdrew their objection and allowed him to go forward with the motion, both in a written motion, and he also orally argued the case. He orally argued that motion. And he did that in a pro se matter, in a manner, even though he had an attorney, which I think is an important factor, because one of the issues people talk about is whether it was inexcusable for this issue not to be raised.
Before we get to that, though, you're making the argument we don't even need to get to that because he raised it. How is raising it on resentencing after direct appeal raising it on direct appeal?
Well, it's a good question, and then it's a little different than Hodges, but Hodges, I think, goes to the idea that this is something the trial court could correct. Hodges says it was at sentencing, so it was the court, even though it was not on appeal, at sentencing they raised it. Again, the issue would have been beforehand. It should have been brought beforehand. The court said, since it was raised at sentencing, we will consider it. So Hodges speaks to it. It doesn't apply directly, but I think it goes to that issue.
Right. Hodges, is that a NAFLA case?
Pardon me?
There
was not an appeal in Hodges, but it was
okay.
But it was post, it would, you know, it was an issue where they considered at sentencing. And that's, you know, so in the same way here, it was considered at sentencing, although it came after the appeal. So it is not directly on point.
Is there anything that tells us that raising something on a remand after a successful appeal is equivalent to raising it on direct appeal?
I have not found anything, Your Honor.
So then you get to, if we decide that it's not raised on direct appeal, then I think you get to the next question of the interest of justice.
Exactly right.
Exception, and you were turning to the deliberate and...
Right, exactly right. And so the idea whether it was deliberately and inexcusably. And I think it's important to note that he raised this in a pro se fashion, and it was quite clear from his defense attorney that his defense attorney wanted nothing to do with this, which I think indicates the problem here, right? And that he was forced to do this in a pro se matter. And
but the question is not how he raised it and resentencing. If we're at the exception, we're assuming that it was not raised on direct appeal.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not talking about resentencing now. So what's the did he put forth to demonstrate that his failure to raise it on direct appeal was not deliberate and inexcusable?
I think the idea was that it's pro se, and that the difficulty of raising an issue that your attorney does not want to argue.
But before the appeal, was he pro se?
He was not pro se.
Okay, so what's the failure to raise it on direct appeal when he's represented by counsel?
I think my point is that his attorney was arguing the cases and arguing the cases. And so Mr. Anderson was not able to raise the issue. And eventually, he did do it in a pro se manner. And I think that just goes to the idea, was it deliberate and inexcusable? And again, it was obviously something the trial attorney did not believe in. The trial attorney did not believe in and demonstrated that he did not believe in it by saying, I'm not even going to argue it. That's Mr. Anderson's motion. He can do that. And so you're putting a pro se defendant in an incredibly difficult position where he has to essentially go against his attorney and say, I want this issue raised. The attorney says, I'm not raising it. And that makes it, I think, clear that it was neither deliberate nor inexcusable because he eventually had to raise it himself. I also think it's important, the idea of just fairness describes it, right? If the Mr. Anderson argument is correct, the state is doing exactly what's prohibited by statute, in that the state is serialized prosecuting Mr. Anderson.
Well, how is that, though? I mean, he's charged on four files. One's a possession with intent charge based upon the pills they find pursuant to a search warrant, and the other three are individual sales on different dates of pills. They spriegle in the sales cases in the possession trial, and he gets acquitted. But the jury made no determination of his guilt or anything on the spriegle. We don't even know how they considered that, obviously. So how is there a serialized prosecution just because they used that spriegel evidence of those other sale cases that they obviously subsequently consolidated into one charge?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And is there a case that supports that?
No, Your Honor, that it is. But I think what it is, it's common sense. And the idea that the argument that the state argued at the time of the first trial, the state argued the reason we want to spriegel this in is it's part of a common scheme and plan. That's why they're allowed to introduce this evidence. It was a common scheme and plan. And what
the argument is more of a double jeopardy argument that you're making, but you're having to make it under the terms under the 609.035, you know, kind of construct.
It is a double, but
well, it can't be a double jeopardy.
Well, I agree, Your Honor, but it is essentially in our 609.035, it's quite clearly has broadened the scope of double jeopardy. And the idea is for cases just like this, an example would be, let's say there were four incidents of sales. Let's just to make a simple example. So the state says, we want to try this one first. We're going to sprinkle in the other three. They gets acquitted. And then he said, okay, we're going to try the next one second. We're going to sprinkle in the three there. And then the third and the fourth. They would try all of them, sprinkling them. That is, I think, a serialized prosecution under 609.035. And 609.035, the difference that talks about is the idea is conduct. And what the cases say specifically, that you have to consider whether there's a common objective, which is exactly what the state argued to get the spriegel in. They said
common scheme or plan. So let's switch to a sexual assault case for purposes of trying to figure out where your rule takes mm-hmm. us. So if you have a sexual assault case and then there's spriegel evidence of a uncharged but clear and convincing evidence proof of a previous sexual assault, close in time, not same behavioral incident, but is let in as a common scheme or plan. Acquittal on the charged sexual assault. You're saying that the state could never prosecute that spriegel sexual assault because it was part of common scheme and plan. I think you're conflating common scheme and plan with same behavioral incident, I think.
I think there's the same issue, right? And I think it's different in the case of where they're accusing him of being a drug dealer.
What I wanted to get to. Like, yeah. You wouldn't think that rule would apply to exclude prosecution later of the
spree
of sexual assault.
I mean, what they're accusing him of is quite clear, is that he's a drug dealer. He sold, the first trial, they weren't accusing him of possessing those. What the first trial was, he is selling these drugs. If he was just charged with possession, it may be different. But they were saying he is selling. So they're accusing him of being a drug dealer.
Don't we have a lot of appellate cases out there where the same issue has been raised, where there's been multiple controlled buys and then multiple charges based on those. And it's been argued that they were part of a common scheme and plan under 609.035. It seems we've rejected that argument already.
I haven't seen a court reject this specific argument. The court, you're correct, Your Honor, in State versus Gold seemed to indicate that if there are separate incidents. But if you look at Gold, interestingly, there were three separate drug buys. There was no discussion of whether it was a Spiegelman or whatever. It was three separate, and that's what the state relies on, these three separate drug buys would seem to be three different incidents. And in fact, in that case, they weren't saying this was part of an overall objective. And in Gold, if you look at Gold, he was an addict who was selling it, and the informant in that case was doing drugs with him. So it was literally three separate incidents. That's not what's occurring here.
So as your rule has, it seems to me, the rule you're trying to get to is it's the same behavioral incident, that's what you need to get to, right, for it to not be, to actually have succeed in your argument.
That's correct.
And common scheme and plan just simply is not the same test as same behavioral incident.
Well, I think the same behavioral incident, for purposes of 609.835, goes to the person's intent. Where there's an intentional crime, the Supreme Court and this court has been quite clear that the most important factor is whether there is an intent. What is the overall criminal objective? So for common scheme and crime, that's exactly the same thing. And that when they say common scheme or plan, that's exactly the same. And that's, again,
But it's not exact. It quite clearly isn't the same as same behavioral incident, because in our sexual assault case, we know it can come in as common scheme and plan, but it's not the same behavioral incident. You look at time and location, and et cetera.
I think that's different, Your Honor, because they're looking, in that case, the argument would be his overall goal is to violate as many women as possible, which is not an intent. Here, the intent is to sell drugs, and that is the criminal intent. So the criminal intent is the same. In those cases, the criminal intent is to sexually assault this person or this person or this person. And the cases are quite clear that, again, when determining the same behavioral incidents, the purpose is you look at the objective. And I urge this court to look at State versus Johnson. When the Supreme Court first started looking at 609.035, and what the court said there quite clearly is what we're doing, what the legislature intended by 609.035 was to enlarge the protection of the double jeopardy, was to enlarge the protection of the double jeopardy clause, and that's what happened here. This was a serial prosecution. They lost the first trial, and then they brought the next case involved. And to be perfectly clear, it's the exact same evidence. I don't know how to make it more of a serial prosecution. Well, it's the same evidence.
Is it, though? I mean, the evidence of the acquitted trial was the actual possession in the house of the four baggies of pills or whatever it was. The evidence in the other cases were sales of drugs, pills, to separate individuals. So it seems to me that those are two different scenarios.
They introduced the evidence from the first trial in there. So it was exactly the same evidence.
But wasn't that offered, though, to show that the pills that were found were the pills of the appellant?
You're correct, Your Honor.
As opposed to appellants sold pills to three separate individuals on other dates.
But my point is, it's the same evidence. They introduced the three sales and the possession in the first trial, and then they introduced the same evidence, the sales and the possession, in the second trial. I don't know how that can be anything other than serial prosecution. They should not...
Well, the sexual assault example. That's why I want you to pin down your rule with respect to this case. What would be your syllabus if this were a published new decision?
When the allegations are the person is a drug dealer and they introduce Spriegel evidence to introduce that, then that is the end of... Then whether it's a conviction or an acquittal, that is the end. That's the common scheme. I mean, when they introduce those, when you introduce the same evidence in two successive trials, the idea is...
In order to prove drug dealing.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, it's quite specific, I think, the argument you're making.
Exactly right, Your Honor. And again, I mean, if you look at the argument the state made, they said this is all part of one scenario. This is the reason we want to introduce the sales into the into the first trial was because it's all one scenario. The reason they want to introduce the possession into the second trial is because it's all one scenario.
So if the charge in the first trial, Mr. Colbert, wasn't possessed, first-degree possession with intent to distribute, it was just a standard first-degree possession because of the amount of the pills that were there, you wouldn't be making this argument today?
If they had not introduced the three sales, it would not be making. The state has the option and clearly could say, you know, four different counts. Possession, here are these three sales. And if they had chose to proceed in that fashion, I think under Gould that you could make that argument. What makes this different is that they made the argument that it was a common scheme or plan. They were the ones who introduced that evidence. That's what differentiates this from Gould. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for responding.
May it please the court, my name is Scott Hersey. I'm a special assistant Isani County attorney, and I represent the respondent in this post-conviction appeal. I'd like to touch on the primary argument as opposed to the procedural bars first. And I would submit that appellants claim that the introduction of Spriegel evidence of control buys in the first trial did not make those things all a single behavioral incident. And I would ask the court to take a look at the complaints. The first complaint in the first file, file 307 in the district court, listed in both the charging language and the probable cause only the possession of the four baggies of 100 pills each, and that was on the specific date of the execution of the search warrant on June 3rd of 2010. Whereas the second complaint, which was amended, aggregated the three dates where there were controlled buys to a specific CRI. And that's indicated both in the specific charging language of that complaint, which made it a first degree, aggregating the three dates, and specifically just the sale to the CRI on specific dates, May 6th, May 10th, and June 1st, with no reference to the June 3rd possession during the time that the officers executed the search warrant. And because those are very specific separate dates, I would submit that Gould and Eaton are controlling. Gould was a decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court from 1997. Eaton was a decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court in 1980. Gould dealt with a situation which I would submit would be analogous to this, that they did say that these are separate behavioral incidents, and they're not just a single behavioral incident. And Eaton was a situation that on two dates closely related in time, individuals obtained checks by swindle from the victim. And the argument there is that you couldn't charge, convict, and sentence the defendant for both of those thefts by swindle of the checks because they were a single behavioral incident. And the court rejected that and said, the argument that the defendant wanted to steal as much as he could does not prevail here. These were clearly separate behavioral incidents, and they rejected that notion. And that's the same notion that I would submit applies in Gould and applies here. Essentially, what counsel is arguing is that the criminal objective here is to sell as many drugs as possible, and it doesn't matter over what time frame. Well, I would submit that under the case law, in fact, citing 2609035 and State versus Johnson all the way back in 1966, and the plethora of cases that have touched on this topic in the intervening years indicates that that's much too broad an objective. And I think that's the exact language of the Supreme Court in rejecting that argument. And so I would submit that that claim is not supported by the case law.
I think what makes this different from those cases is though they were introduced, it wasn't just whether the three, I'm having maybe trouble articulating the appellant's argument, so I may not do it right, so I look forward to be corrected. But those, it's not a question whether if you looked at those three, if they were just prosecuted, would they be part of a single behavioral incident or not. But because they were used to show a common intent or an intent, as Spriegel evidence in the other possession with intent to sell, that changes it, and it turns that into a serial prosecution when you fail on that, and like, okay, well, let's go to each of the individual sales then.
Well, I would point out a couple of things, Judge. One is that the first charge was possession of 400 pills in the house found during the search warrant with the intent to sell. It wasn't an actual sale. Whereas in the second complaint that was aggregated, those were actual sales recorded, controlled buys, with the defendant actually recorded during some of those. And so I would submit that that is one reason why we ought to say that this is not a single behavioral incident.
But so, the state could have charged the first count, the first trial, just straight first-degree possession based on the amount of pills alone, right?
The state could have.
Yeah, but it chose then. I think that's what the argument is. I mean, it's kind of like the state made its bed, so now it should sleep in it because the state chose to add the with intent to distribute. And to support that argument to the jury, not only did they have the amount of pills, but they were showing, and he's been selling them on three separate occasions, and the jury rejected that. I think that's part of, it seems like the state kind of boxed itself in on this a little bit by trying the case in the way it did and the order it did.
If we were to follow that line, Judge, I would submit that that would essentially turn Spriegel on its head. It would defeat the scores of Spriegel cases that we have, and it would defeat, again, scores of decisions under 609.035, which make very specific and fact-specific decisions as to what are single behavioral incidents and what are separate behavioral incidents. And that would require essentially overruling two very extensive bodies of casework and or case law. And I would submit that that's not justified here. And I would submit that analogizing, as counsel did, to four different specific sales and spriggling in back and forth and back and forth is not the situation we have here. And again, I would submit a close reading of Gould and Eaton shows that the Supreme Court has rejected the idea of a single criminal objective to do as much wrong, whether it's embezzling as in Eaton or doing as much drug sales as possible in Gould, that those are controlling. And I would submit that those should be applied in this particular case. And I would submit that the Supreme Court's analysis of single behavioral incidents in those situations should govern. The common objective is not a common objective in each particular case broad enough to make these into a single behavioral incident. And we have, as I indicated, a significant body of case law on that. And I would also say that there's really no justification that I can see in law for making a special exception to well-established Spriegel case law just for drug cases. I would submit that that's never been distinguished out by the Minnesota Supreme Court, and I would submit that it would not be justified in this case, and I would submit that applying the doctrines under Spriegel by the Minnesota Supreme Court would dictate this is not a single behavioral incident. Moving on to the issue about whether or not this is barred by either NAFLA or 590.01, first of all, I would point out, since it came up during counsel's argument, that the appellant was represented throughout all of this by counsel. He was represented at the first trial. He was represented at the second trial. He was represented on appeal. And so just...
File a pro se brief on appeal? A supplemental brief, do you know?
In this case, he did.
In the previous, the direct appeal?
I can't say 100% with 100% certainty, but I believe he did in the prior case. And counsel is correct. He did file that motion by himself, and he did argue it, and argued it fairly extensively. But I would submit that under both NAFLA and 590.01, that this issue about 609.035 and whether or not there would be a bar to a second prosecution was known by the defendant and defendant's counsel at the time of the acquittal on the prior offense. It was known at the time of the amendment of the complaint, the second complaint, to become a first degree in the aggregation of the various counts. It was known all throughout trial, and it was certainly known during the time of the direct appeal. Yet the defendant did not raise it until his own motion on resentencing. And I would submit that that is contrary to 590.01 subdivision 4. And I would submit that he missed the timeline. It says, no petition for post-conviction relief may be filed more than 2 years after the later of the entry of judgment of conviction or sentence if no direct appeal is filed or an appellate court's disposition of petitioner's direct appeal.
I didn't see, counsel, the time bar being raised before the post-conviction court by the state. Was it raised before this appeal?
I can't say with specificity, Judge. I thought it was, but I can't be certain.
Okay. If it was not raised to the post-conviction court, is it not forfeited, that argument here?
That may well be the case if it was not raised. But I believe it would have been raised at some point. And I remember there were objections to it by counsel at the resentencing. But in any event, I would point out that the judgment of...
I think that would have preceded the post-conviction petition, right, at resentencing?
There was a resentencing, and mm-hmm. after the resentencing is when there was the filing of the post-conviction
right.
petition.
So the timeliness of the petition, post-conviction petition, we'll just look at it. I didn't see it in the writing or in the transcript, but I just wondered if you had...
The petition was filed on September 14th of 2018. Mm-hmm. The original sentencing was on 9/19 of 13. The direct appeal was resolved by the opinion of this court on 6/8 of 15, and that was followed by a judgment of conviction for that on 8/17 of 15. And so using any of those dates, it is more than 3 years later when the post-conviction petition was filed on September 14 of 2018. And I submit that we do not go by the date of the resentencing. There is nothing in 590.01 subdivision 4 that says anything about a remand or resentencing. The legislature certainly knows how to add that and was quite specific. And since this was not brought up, I would submit that it is barred. And I would submit it's also barred by NAFLA, which language has been expanded by both Black v. State and Colbert v. State. Anything that was known or should have been known and is not brought up within the time frame is barred. And so I would focus on those issues, and I would respectfully ask the court to affirm the post-conviction court's determination in all respects. Thank you.
Mr. Colbert?
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple points. This was not raised in the post-conviction. I addressed that in my reply. It was not addressed. The state did not raise it. And also, I think it's important, the state wants to focus on the date of the Court of Appeals decision, but what the Court of Appeals says, they reversed and remanded, and that, it doesn't make any sense for the time to start running then. It's difficult to understand why it would start running at that time because the case is still open. Traditionally, in criminal cases, the time starts running at sentencing. So it was reversed and remanded. He was resentenced, and therefore that's when the time should start running. And I think that's quite clear.
So your position is October 13, 2016 should be the date that the clock starts running on.
Exactly. When he was resentenced, that's when he has 2 years after resentencing. And It talks about an appellate court's disposition of the petitioner's direct appeal. If they reverse it and then there is a reverse the trial and then the trial doesn't happen for 2 years, is he precluded from filing a post-conviction? That cannot be the way the law works. It is clearly from resentencing.
So can you speak to what, if we were to look at this and say, well, on his direct appeal, he's represented by counsel, there's no allegation or no assertion of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel here. He had the opportunity to, and maybe in fact did, we can check, file a supplemental brief on the direct appeal. Maybe you know the answer to that.
I don't. I'm sorry.
Okay. But he at very least had the opportunity to, and clearly knew about it, and you're arguing his later resentencing efforts, pro se efforts, shows that even though they knew about it, his lawyer didn't support it. So let's back up and assume that his lawyer knew about it based on that. But if he had the opportunity to raise it directly on appeal through a supplemental brief, and there's no ineffective assistance of counsel charge. Why isn't, what tells us that it's not deliberate and inexcusable?
Well, I think it's the idea of, is the idea of fairness is the bottom line here. And in the sense of it is it fair in this particular case? And the state, as today, evidence, they don't argue prejudice. They don't argue that somehow this prevents us from making the argument. That makes sense to me if you're just saying, look, we would have been able to address this way or that way, then that's a reasonable argument. But to simply just say it's waived, therefore. And I was looking through the cases regarding this, and it's not clear to me why the Supreme Court decided that 609.035 regarding serial prosecution can be waived, but 609.04 regarding serial punishment cannot be waived. And they somehow have split those two, which, frankly, it's not clear to me. But then if you look at Johnson, what happened in Johnson makes it clear as to why they split. And in the sense in Johnson, what the person did was pled guilty in the hopes of voiding the other prosecution for DWI. And so what I think in this particular incident where you're dealing with serial prosecution, we're arguing as a matter of law that this should not have been a serial prosecution. It should not be barred by NAFLA. And as a fundamental fairness of it. And again, Mr. Anderson on his own brought it up. And the difficulty of...
So this is this a new argument? You're saying that the NAFLA framework shouldn't apply at all to 609.035 arguments?
I'm giving context. The cases have been quite clear that 609.035 regarding prosecution is waivable. The 609.035 regarding punishment is not waivable. And I was just trying to figure out why the Supreme Court went there. But it's quite clear the Supreme Court has said that. So this is something this court can't deal with. And it is, but it is unclear to me why that is. But I think that goes to the fundamental fairness of our argument. I do want to point out just how difficult it is, this bench is well aware, of a individual defendant trying to raise issues when their attorney is not doing it. Most of the time, the defendant will simply just go along. It is difficult to speak up. It's incredibly difficult to do it anyways, and it makes it even more difficult when your attorney is saying, don't raise it. This isn't my issue. That's his issue. I'm not arguing this. So for all these reasons, we think it's appropriate for this court to consider the issue. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We have your briefs and your arguments. They were helpful to the court, and we will take the matter under advisement at this time, and we'll issue a decision within 90 days. Thank you. I'm going to check and see if they're ready to go, Emily. I know we're a little early here.